This is Audible.
Podium Publishing presents The True Measure, Terran Armor Corps, Book 3. Written by Richard Fox. Performed by Luke Daniels. Prologue. Howling winds whipped snow across the mountain range as a single mule transport descended from orbit. The gale swayed the ship from side to side as it sank beneath the side of a mountain range, the white caps of blown snow stretching like grasping hands toward the mule. It sat down in a valley, running lights on and idling engines melting the snowpack. In the cargo compartment, a woman unbuckled herself from an acceleration seat and shrugged off a coat. She pulled her long blonde hair into a ponytail and touched a bulge in a thigh pocket.
"This is the place."
A burly man unsnapped a Gauss carbine from the side of his chair and slapped in a magazine.
"Put that away, Medvedev. You'll make them nervous," she said.
"They want to meet on some no-name world in a no-name system for the exchange. They're already nervous. Having this means we don't trust, because you should never trust nervous people. You taught me that, Masha," he said.
"I can't wait for you to go back to the Legions, you know that?"
She walked down the empty cargo bay. She leaned close to the closed ramp, listening to the wind outside.
"Don't get captured by high-ish gangsters. The agency won't assign you a bodyguard."
Medvedev rolled his shoulders forward and tapped the carbine against a meaty palm.
"I hardly need..."
Three knocks sounded at the ramp.
"Punctual," she said. "They are nervous."
Medvedev raised the carbine to his shoulder as the ramp lowered. Snow broke against the weak force field separating the wintry world beyond and the cargo bay. A Vishrakoth marched up the ramp. The ant-like alien walked upright on four limbs and wore nothing to protect its bare flesh from the elements. Two more Vishrakoth came behind it, carrying a large metal case.
"The item." The lead alien extended a hand toward Masha.
"That's not how this works," she said. "I verify what you've brought, make sure you didn't kill it in the cold. Then you can examine what I've got."
"We have what you want. Make the trade and conclude our business," the alien said.
"Take off your coat. Stay a while."
Masha took a hand scanner off her belt and shook it at the two Vishrakoth between her and the case. Medvedev took two steps forward before the aliens got out of the way. Masha ran the scanner over the lock and the lid popped open. Inside were several bags of green fluid in a chiller. She gave one bag a squeeze, then touched the scanner to it.
"Grade A green blood cells."
She touched the scanner to another bag.
"Just what the doctor ordered to combat infectious diseases the galaxy over. Where did you guys get this?"
"The security apparatus on New Bastion is less than efficient,"
the lead Vishrakoth said.
"We intercepted it in customs en route to your embassy."
"Not our embassy."
She took a small box out of her thigh pocket and tossed it to the alien. The Vishrakoth removed a small plate from its utility belt and set the box on top. A hologram of a spacecraft modeled after a conch shell appeared over the box. Reams of data flashed up and down the sides of the holo.
"Why would you part with such knowledge?"
the alien asked.
"This artifact is far more priceless than a few liters of green blood cells."
"Well, no one's found it yet."
Masha brushed the scanner along the inside of the case.
"And we have a colony full of people dying because their immune system encountered a virus we didn't find when we scouted the planet. The Vishrakoth understand that a bird in hand is worth more than two in the bush?"
"We do not."
The alien slipped the box into a pouch.
"Oria Kilcheko Begerin Batein,"
she said to Medvedev.
"What?"
The skin around the Vishrakoth's eyes darkened.
"Another old saying. The trade was green blood cells for our data on the Ka'resh Ark that's hidden somewhere in the galaxy. Not for green blood cells in a case with a tracking device. I was going to kill you and feel bad about it. Now I'm just going to kill you out of principle."
She aimed her thumb and forefinger at the Vishrakoth.
Earth humor is not appreciated. The case?
The alien's head exploded with one shot from Medvedev's carbine. He cut down the other two a heartbeat later.
Amateurs!
Masha lifted up a seat and pulled out a cooler with biohazard labels on it. She transferred the blood pouches as Medvedev removed the data box from the dead alien, then kicked the alien corpses down the ramp. Masha let her bodyguard get rid of the case with the tracking device as she tapped in a command on her forearm computer.
Warsaw, we've got the jackpot. Send the fighter strike to destroy their lander and take out whatever rock they came in. Send word back to Lady Barra that Balmaceda will have their green blood cells soon. We'll take the rest back to Navarre for processing as soon as we can.
Medvedev raised the ramp.
See? She said. I didn't even need you.
I don't find you funny. I would be angrier, but I got to kill aliens. Today's a good day.
Oh, by the saint, how long do I have to deal with you?
She said, almost pouting. Soon after the exchange ended on the unnamed and unclaimed ice planet, the Warsaw passed through the system's crucible jump gate. Inside a bag of green blood cells, inert nanites were roused to life by the graviton disturbance. They melded into a small machine and sent a single transmission through the crucible network. Then, once the graviton field faded away as the Warsaw transited through the wormhole, the nanomachine broke apart and returned to slumber. Chapter 1 Frost grew around the bars of Roland's cell. His breath fogged with each exhalation, and his soaked body gloves stiffened against him as the amniosis fluid from his armor's womb thickened in the frigid air. In the next cell over, a metal man cocked his head to one side and stepped closer to the bars between them. His head was a perfect sculpture of middle-aged man of European heritage, but the skin and widow's peaked hair were silver, his every feature marked out by slight lines in the metal. Covering his body was a simple jumpsuit of the same silver color, like he was an incomplete drawing of a man, the lines inked but the rest uncolored.
"Like I said, I'm Mark Ibarra," the man said.
His mouth didn't move when he spoke, but a slight ripple emanated across his face.
"You have heard of me, haven't you? It's not like I was gone from Earth that long."
The chill air stung the edges of Roland's ears, and his fingers ached. He stepped back, his heel cracking a thin sheen of ice on the floor of his cell.
"What the hell are you?"
Roland asked, nearly slipping as he retreated to a bunk bolted to the wall.
"Inventor? Entrepreneur? Bold explorer? Savior?"
Ibarra leaned his forearms against the bars as hoarfrost crept away from where his metal limbs met the bars.
"I've been called much worse, too. Now I'm a prisoner, one so unique, or utterly irrelevant, I don't even rate a number. Maybe now that you're down here, the guards will have to do something to tell us apart, though I doubt they'll ever confuse us."
He pulled back, and his arms caught against the bars, frozen in place.
"What the?"
His brow furrowed, and he pulled his forearms free with a snap.
"Ah! That's right. Keep forgetting. They keep my cell's temperature and humidity regulated to stop this sort of thing. That I was throwing snowballs at the Tweedles after I was thrown in here probably had something to do with that. And why they took my sink and crapper away. Not that I needed them."
Is everyone here like you?"
Roland wrapped a blanket around his shoulders, and frost in his body glove cracked as he huddled against his mattress for warmth.
"Stacy Ibarra?"
He spat the name out as his teeth chattered.
"She was..."
Mark Ibarra looked up at the ceiling and shouted,
"Help the kid out! He's turning blue! And I don't want a popsicle in my cell block!"
He stepped back from the bars. Roland didn't feel any warmer, but at least the air around him seemed to stabilize. A vent behind thin crisscrossing bars blew hot, wet air that turned to mist in Roland's cell. After a few minutes, Roland flung his blanket aside and squeezed the last of the amniosis from his body glove.
"The guards are listening to us, and watching us too would be a fair guess,"
Roland said, glancing around the cell. The jail was comprised of only two cells and a narrow hallway that ended at a vault door.
"That they answered me just means they assume you're not an idiot. Don't underestimate Stacy, kiddo,"
Marky Barra said.
"I made that mistake, and you can see where it landed me. All those decades of scheming and manipulating, I taught her too well. Most grandfathers I know would want their future generations to surpass them, but with Stacy, I would have been happy for her to live a normal, humdrum life. You know, a career, a pudgy husband with a decent office job, two kids and change. Not in the cards for her, or anyone on Earth." "You said we're in Navarre, capital of the Ibarra Nation. Where exactly is that? How do I get back to Earth?"
Roland asked.
"Oh, you're an optimistic one. Well, to get home, all you need to do is break out of this cell, get past the many, many humorless guards in this building, commandeer a spacecraft, get to the Crucible Gate, and enter in the code for Ceres or some other Earth solar system, all the while being chased by Stacy's forces. And I've got news for you, kid,"
Ibarra said, tapping the back of his head where Roland's plugs were.
"You're not going to blend in." "Guess I won't. Not if everyone's as solid as you are."
"What? Well, this old thing." Ibarra slapped his palms against his chest and thighs, each hit ringing like a bell through their cells.
"I'm afraid Stacy and I are the only ones sporting a Kar-Resh ambassador body. Everyone else is just as fleshy as you are, though your hardware is something special. How long have you been armor? Dr. Eeks still kicking around Mars?"
Roland bit his lip and looked up, wondering where all the monitoring equipment was hidden throughout the cell block.
"Come on now." Ibarra pointed to a data slate on the end of his bunk. "I've been down here with nothing but a bricked e-reader for months. Getting caught up on my reading is nice and all, but it gets dull after a while. Been months since I've spoken to anyone. The Tweedles aren't that talkative." "Maybe your granddaughter threw me in here to get me to reveal military secrets during idle conversation. I have a duty to resist any interrogation. How about we just keep quiet?"
Ibarra shook his head.
"You're how old? 20? I bet you were armor no more than a year or so before Stacy snagged you off a battlefield. I was a major power behind Earth's government for the last 80 years, though I've had something of a setback these past few months. If you knew something particularly useful, my protege would have put you someplace far less comfortable than our little slice of paradise."
"So you're not that big of a deal anymore?" Roland picked up a tube of nutrient paste from the floor and squeezed the grainy tomato-flavored meal into his mouth. Stacy Barra and her bodyguard, an armor soldier named Nicodemus, had captured him on Oricon days ago, ripped him out of his armor and carted him away, still sealed in his suit's womb. Time was difficult to gauge while in the abyss of an unpowered metal pod. The amniosis had kept him alive, but it had been so long since he'd eaten real food, the paste tasted like the ambrosia of legend.
"Walked right into that one, didn't I?" Ibarra shrugged. "Oh, how the mighty have fallen. I bet President Garrett and his cronies in the Senate would be just tickled pink to know where I'm at, though they should have some clue I'm in trouble, as I've not been around to feed them information for quite a while."
"You were spying for Earth?" Roland grabbed a water bottle on the end of his bed. Bits of half-formed ice swirled around in the liquid, and the cold plastic stung his palm. He took a small sip, spilling plenty of it down his chin. Using his own body after so long in armor took some getting used to.
"Mediating," Ibarra said, raising a finger. "Trying to keep Earth from coming after us. Trying to get Earth to see the errors of their ways in approving the Hale Treaty. Trying to keep Stacy from losing all hope. She just used that time to build up the nation, keep after her little pet projects. Now I realize she was playing me. Brilliant move on her part. I'm almost proud. Earth never felt threatened by us so long as I was around to rein her in. Stacy kept me in play until I was on the verge of telling Earth exactly how many proceeds we had and where to find Navarre.
Wait. Roland set the water bottle against his knee. I know you've got your own procedurally generated soldiers. I met some on Oricon. You were Earth's spy, and you didn't tell them how many you were making?
I may have lied. I've been known to do that, and am of the opinion that one should not tell the truth when a lie will do. Old habit, born out of necessity and practice. But when Stacy decided it was time to leave Earth, along with a few like-minded individuals, like Nicodemus, you've met him? Isn't he fun? We skipped town with a fleet Earth wasn't even using, and some technology that I kept off the books for a rainy day. A small omnium reactor, construction droids, automated foundries, and a number of procedural generation tubes with psych compilers. How did you keep all that hidden?
I'm Mark Ibarra. I kept an impending Zaros invasion secret for 60 years, and laid the groundwork to take Earth back with no one the wiser. You think keeping a secret stash was a challenge? Granted, I had help along the way.
He looked over at the only drawer in a small desk by his bed.
So President Garrett thought you got away with only a fleet of ghost ships and a few armor soldiers, but the whole time you were making your own army and navy. It was a matter of prudence at first. Help crew the ships and build up Navarre. Then Stacy had more militant aims.
How many?
Roland asked. Mark Ibarra's head shook slightly from side to side, then he smiled.
Now you're gonna clam up?
Roland shifted back and leaned against the wall.
I don't actually know, Ibarra said. She started a rather aggressive expansion plan after she found some information on Barada. I found the creches by accident, a power drain in the lower cavern, so many new people coming into the world. That's when I signaled Earth for a meet, to finally spill the beans. And that's when Nicodemus ripped me out of my air car and almost crushed my head. He's many things. Subtle isn't one of them.
I notice.
Roland worked his shoulder around. The Ibarran armor soldier had demolished Roland's own armor in their brief and one-sided fight. The phantom pain from those injuries still nagged at him.
It takes 9 days for a procedural tube and psych compilers to make a fully grown, fully trained adult, Ibarra said. The technology was our saving grace against the Zaros. I wanted to phase out the program after the war, let humanity do things the way nature intended. Stacy had other goals, other needs, shall we say.
What happened to her?
To you?
Roland asked.
I couldn't stand around and watch her die.
Ibarra's face fell.
I was there, you know, when the Zaros scoured the Earth clean of every last human being, billions dead to the drones. I heard the screams, saw the cities burn. But when I saw my granddaughter bleeding to death in front of me, I could not let her go.
He tapped the side of his head.
I wasn't exactly corporeal when Stacy needed me the most, but there was a Koresh ambassador unit just lying around that I appropriated. I got her body into stasis and her mind into the shell you've already met.
Roland squeezed out the last of his nutrient paste and gave Ibarra a sidelong look.
Ambassador unit?
Ibarra waved his hands up his body.
Obviously, he said. The Kar-Resh had a good system going on Bastion before the Zaros destroyed it. Bringing ambassadors from across the galaxy to one place was difficult without the crucible gates we have now. So the Kar-Resh sent probes to planets with species that could fight the Zaros, put their bodies into stasis, and transported the consciousness of the ambassadors to Bastion, where they got one of these numbers to walk around in. This made the ambassadors effectively immortal. No aging, no risk of spreading disease. Through some advanced holotechnology and translation programs, all the ambassadors saw the other races as a species that looked like them, spoke like them. But Bastion could never make any of the ambassadors think like each other, which is still a problem.
And you just happened to have two of these ambassador bodies handy?
Palon, the long-time Dotari rep to Bastion, wasn't using his. Stacy had hers. I got attached to this one, and Palon decided to retire after the war ended and the Dotari went back to their homeworld. It's a hassle around anyone not prepped for Arctic temperatures, but it sure beats living inside a Kar-Resh probe. No more genie-in-a-bottle routine for me.
Roland got to his feet and rubbed soreness out of his neck and jaw.
Is this why you two dropped off the edge of the world after the Ember War was over? Because you were that?
Ibarra crossed his arms over his chest and paced up and down his cell.
Most of humanity was wiped out by the Zaros. You were in the fleet that sidestepped the invasion, so you know what that mess was like. Reconstruction. The Toth show up. Everyone realizes that I've snuck Procyes into the population. The Zaros arrive in that hollowed-out moon. More fighting. Then the war's over, and now it's time to let the immortal Mark and Stacy Ibarra run the show. My plan was never for me to control humanity forever. Just long enough to get through what would have been an extinction event. I thought I'd stay in that probe forever, but staying out of the limelight after the war seemed natural. Stacy, though, her trauma was never part of the plan.
What exactly happened to her? Ripples spread across Ibarra's face, but there was no sound. The metal man's face contorted in confusion. He looked up and shook a fist at the roof. The light dimmed in his cell and a privacy screen formed between his cell's bars.
Hey! Roland shouted. I'm talking to him!
His words echoed off the stone walls of the prison.
Damn it!
He kicked his bunk, got a spike of pain for his efforts, then sat down on the bunk and looked over his enclosure. A sink and toilet, small drain in the floor. He went to the small metal desk and opened its single drawer. Empty.
I am a prisoner of war, he thought. I am not a criminal. I am armor. I still have my duties.
Roland sank to one knee and bowed his head in prayer.
Sancti Spiritus, et sit nobis gratia.
Chapter 2. Gideon leaned against the railing of the observation pod. A wide oval window in the crucible offered a view to the center of the gigantic jump gate, Ceres' horizon, and to Earth beyond. He'd been there for almost an hour, watching silently as the white planes of wormholes, humanity's link to the stars, opened and shut. The basalt walls of the crucible and the twinkle of golden flecks in the material told of the crucible's alien construction. The miles-long and wide thorns that made up the crucible shifted between each jump. He'd found no rhyme or reason to the station's movements, but knew they were integral to manipulating the graviton fields between the countless thousands of other crucibles the Zaros seeded throughout the galaxy. He felt the vibration of approaching footsteps through the catwalk.
Tongea,
Gideon said without looking over.
How did you know?
The other armor soldier stopped next to Gideon and put his hands on the railing.
You walk like you're ready for a fight,
Gideon said. The Maori grunted as the flash of an opening wormhole lit across the tribal tattoos on his face.
It's a struggle to keep the mind focused when out of armor, Tongea said. My sync rating always suffers.
Gideon finally looked at the other armor soldier.
And instead of going back to the Ardennes to plug in, you came up here to find me. When will my lance be reassigned to the fleet searching for the Ibaras?
He asked.
Your request was denied,
Tongea said curtly. Gideon slammed a fist against the railing.
Bullshit, Tongea! The Ibaras took Roland away from us, from me. He is my responsibility, and I won't let another risk themselves when I'm the one at fault.
No one blames you for what happened. The Ibaras overpowered Roland and Agnar, then took Roland's womb and—
I am to blame.
Gideon tapped his own chest quickly.
I gave the order to split up the lance while we were on that Karesh station. I refused to fire on Stacy Barr and her pack of traitors. That she got away with the alien tech and my soldier are on me. No one else.
You split your lance to stop Shareel from redlining. If you'd tried to stop Ibarra from leaving, then Ignar and the rest of your company would have been lost when the station sank into Oricon Prime. You made the right decision. Don't let your history with the Nicodemus cloud your judgment,
Tongea said.
You think I can ever forget or forgive what he did?
Gideon squeezed a hand into a fist so tight his knuckles went white.
They betrayed the core. Earth. Me. And for what? Some sort of mysticism?
He reached out to touch the Templar cross on Tongea's shoulder. Tongea's hand snapped out and grabbed Gideon by the wrist. The two strained against each other for a moment. Then Gideon let his arm go slack, and Tongea released his grip.
There were plenty of Templar that stayed behind, Tongea said. No one believes Nicodemus and the others did the right thing by siding with the Ibaras.
No one? I'm not part of your little brotherhood, but don't think I'm ignorant to what you Templar believe,
Gideon said. Tongea stiffened and turned back to the viewport.
Those that went with the Ibaras have been expunged from the honor roll, cast out. They are no longer my brothers or sisters. Not Nicodemus, not Morrigan, not—
Don't say his name.
Gideon leaned his hands against the railing and let his head droop between his shoulders.
They were my friends, too,
Tongea said, laying his hand on Gideon's shoulder.
I have to find them,
Gideon said as he shrugged the touch away.
I have to find Roland.
Colonel Martell needs you elsewhere, someplace where you'll do far more for Earth than bringing traitors to justice. New Bastion.
Where all the old Alliance sits around doing nothing, what the hell am I gonna do there?
Gideon's brow furrowed.
The Ibaras have been busy. They've raided more than one alien planet, and the Congress on New Bastion demands answers from Earth. You're going there as a witness, to try to keep the rest of the galaxy from dogpiling on us while we figure out what to do about the Ibaras,
Tongea said.
But we have to find the Ibaras first, which is proving harder than we thought.
A witness? No. Send Admiral Leto or the Oricon governor. I can't add anything more than they already know. Let me bring the Ibaras back in chains. New Bastion can watch the video of their trial and execution for treason.
Leto's taking the Ardennes to New Bastion. You and your lance are going with him. Martell's orders. By the time you get back, the Keeper thinks she'll have a way to track the Ibaras' movement through the Crucible Network. Then we'll be ready to enact justice.
Gideon shook his head.
I don't do well around aliens, he said. I saw what the Toth did to prisoners on Hawaii. Saw the dead on Cygnus killed by the Vishrakath.
The Toth are gone, and you do well enough with your Dotari Lancer. Our ambassador there will help keep you in line.
Tongea, sir.
Chariel is on her way. She's recovering well from a near headline. I wanted her in my lands, but someone took her on a shoestring tackle of an operation against the Vish, and there was no separating her from that lance.
I regret nothing,
Gideon said.
Go to New Bastion, tell the truth, then hunt down the Ibaras after that.
We're going to kill the Ibaras when we find them. Promise me that,
Gideon said.
President Garrett could be forced to ask for a declaration of war in the next few days,
Tongea said, his face falling as he spoke.
It takes time to get the public behind something like that, especially since we as a culture should have moved on from fighting each other after the Ember War.
The Ibaras are to blame, and they're going to pay for what they've done,
Gideon said. A bright light passed over Shareel's left eye. She fought the urge to blink, but the slight numbness across her body made dealing with the discomfort easier. She ran the blunted talon on her thumb across the side of her index finger. Dr. Eek said as she moved the light to Shareel's other eye.
No moving while the neurometer is attached.
The human woman was older than most of her kind Shareel had encountered, with gray hair and lined skin typical of those well past what humans considered middle age. The aroma of burnt herbs clung to her lab coat, a byproduct of an addiction that seemed oddly prevalent among human medical workers. Shareel flared her nostrils in annoyance. The device interfacing with her skull plugs was heavy and sent tiny electrical jolts through her muscles for the last 10 minutes of the exam.
What do you think, Dr. Bargum?
Eeks asked over her shoulder to the Dotari staring intently at the holoscreen displaying Shareel's nervous system.
Neural kinetics are well within normal, he said. She experienced a minor system spike, not a true red line. My recommendation stands.
I can't find any reason to keep her off active duty, Eek said, though her hormone levels have certainly spiked.
Then clear me for deployment,
Shareel said. The neurometer punished her with tiny shocks to the muscles she dared to voluntarily control.
Don't, dearie. Things have a tendency to bite.
Eeks reached behind Shareel's head and removed the neurometer with a click. Then she slipped the palm-sized device into her lab coat.
Our jogger will link up with the crucible in a few more hours. You can join your lance then. I'll have the paperwork done up after my smoke break.
Thank you, doctor.
Shareel rubbed the skin around her plugs, noting it was more sensitive than usual.
I'd tell you to stay away from any weird geometry in Karesh artifact worlds, but I doubt that'll happen,
she said, getting halfway out the door before looking back to Bargil.
Coming, doctor?
I need a few minutes with her,
the Dotari said.
I'll catch up.
He waited until Eeks was gone before he took a data slate out of his coat pocket.
Your hormone levels are indeed above normal,
he said in the clicks and tweets of Dotari language.
The homeworld removed all the contraceptives from our food and water. This is to be expected, yes?
Bargil removed a pen-sized device and pressed the tip under her beak. He looked down at his data slate and clicked his tongue.
Not to this extent. Your pheromone glands are swollen. Have you been exposed to anything unusual? Eaten something not from the food processors?
The doctor asked. Shareel worked her jaw slightly, then gripped her hands together over her lap.
I've been eating coffee berries,
she mumbled.
Uh-huh,
he said, putting the device back in his pocket.
We did note an uptick in the birth rate during our stay on Hawaii.
I'll send word back to Dotari that raw coffee berries warrant further study.
What's happening back home? She asked. My father sent word that there's some sort of illness, and that's why we're barred from going back, and that's why the Council of Firsts lifted the restrictions on breeding.
They're calling it the phage,
Bargeel said.
When our ancestors fled the Zaros on the generation ships, we lost so much of our history and culture. Turns out we also lost our immunity to certain diseases present on our homeworld. We spent so much time in the clean environment of spaceships, and our home on Tekini had little to nothing in the way of microbes that could threaten us. Every Dotari on the homeworld is at risk, the young and elderly especially. The fatality rate is over 70%. More and more healthy adults are succumbing too.
The humans have their green blood cells to protect them from such things. Why haven't they shared the technology with us?
The Garish devised the green blood cells as a byproduct of the outlawed procedural generation program.
Bargeel's quills shuddered in disgust.
The green blood cells only work for the humans, but they've sent medical teams and are working with our scientists for a cure. Unfortunately, our physiology is quite different. Humans will learn to fly by flapping their arms before one of them could function as a Dotari physician.
Shareel touched the plugs beneath her loose quills.
Mechanical? Not biological,
Bargeel snapped.
What's going to happen to us? To the homeworld? She asked.
If the phage continues on its current disease vector, a few hundred Dotari will survive the next decade.
Bargeel delivered the prognosis clinically, ignoring Shareel's gasp.
Many more in our expeditionary fleet and those assigned to joint commands like you. After that, those who outlast the phage may develop new immunity, and we could return, though the Council of Firsts gives that a low probability.
We are doomed, aren't we?
Shareel wrung her hands together.
We survived the Zaros through great effort and sacrifice, and with the humans' help,
we will do the same again. You understand why your reproductive cycle has been restarted?
The doctor asked.
I do. I feel like I'm going through puberty all over again.
The skin around her eyes flushed with embarrassment.
You're not the first to share that observation. You're in a joint unit with the humans. Are they aware?
They are not. Between the conflict with the Abara faction and my hospitalization, I've not had the chance to explain why my pheromones are in the air.
She shifted uncomfortably on the exam table. The doctor held out his hand.
The coffee berries? I'll not have your system upset any further.
Shareel clicked her beak in annoyance and removed a small case from a thigh pocket and handed it over.
What now?
She asked.
Nature.
The doctor slid the case into his lab coat and left. Ignar squeezed past a marine guard in the corridor leading to his berthing on the Ardenne. The marine gave him a nod as he passed, eyes lingering on Ignar's bare metal cybernetic hands and the speaker in his throat. Always the looks, Ignar thought. He pressed a shoulder pocket holding his access card to a door panel and kicked the bottom of the door frame as he went into his room. He stumbled forward and attempted to catch the bulkhead, but his hands didn't open in time to brace his fall. The backs of his hands slid off the bulkhead and his shoulder took the brunt of the impact. He sat against the wall and looked at his feet, both clumsy cybernetics within boots fastened by straps. His shoulder throbbed for a moment, but the shame of being forced to toddle around in full view of everyone bothered him more. He flexed his metal fingers open and closed with the whine of servos. The Vishrakoth grenade had taken much from him on Cygnus. The pain had been brief, the long recovery filled with failed transplant surgeries and rehabilitation were much worse. The hands bent back at the wrist and went flat, and he rolled over and pushed himself up with the grace of a drunk struggling out of an alley. He sat on a disheveled bunk and stared at the other pristine bed, Roland's bed. Neither of them brought much in the way of personal gear, as most of their time and all their fighting would be spent in armor, but the pair of spit-shined boots and a duffel bag in the footlocker bolted to the floor were a constant reminder that Roland should have been there. Ignar ran the fight with the Ibaran armor through his mind again. He and Roland had focused on Stacy Ibarra, her unnatural metal body standing in the Ka'resh data center. She had called Nicodemus out of a portal to deal with the Terran armor. Nicodemus had cut Ignar's armor in half at the waist, rendering him useless in seconds before he hacked away at Roland. With Ibarra as a distraction, the ambush was perfect. Overwhelming force from an unexpected direction, textbook and flawless, Ignar knew he was lucky to even be alive. But that hadn't tempered the shame he felt. Together, he and Roland might have stood a chance against Nicodemus. Instead, Ignar's swift defeat likely slowed Roland's response, and now his friend was their prisoner. That he just left an audience where he explained his failure to his entire chain of command, including President Garrett, was a cherry on top of a worsening day. A data slate beeped beneath his pillow. He opened one hand like a clamp, gripped the slate, and saw a flashing reminder that the Ardennes had fellowship for the embarked Templar armor. Roland would have been excited for this, even though it meant a good thrashing with a bamboo training sword from the full members of the Order. No one expected Ignar to learn the blade, not with him being a cripple. The memory of Nicodemus, a Templar cross emblazoned on his shoulder, standing over Roland's broken armor, came to him, and Ignar squeezed the data slate until the screen cracked. He bashed his metal hand against the bedframe again and again, until the slate broke into pieces and went bouncing across the deck. He pried his closed hand open with the other, then lay his forearms on his lap. Slowly and with great concentration, he tapped the tips of his forefingers against their thumbs, then the middle finger, then down to his pinkies and back up to the first digits. Roland was gone. Ignar's faith in the Templar faded faster the more he thought about Nicodemus and the armor that rebelled with the Ibarras. And he was out of his armor. He leaned his head back against the bulkhead while his fingers tapped against each other. Chapter 3. The clang of a metal door woke Roland from sleep. He shot up in bed and set his feet to the floor as a pair of beefy guards came through the open vault door, both in light power armor. The one in front carried a nightstick that crackled as he moved. The other held a tray of food. Both were baby-faced and thick-necked. Neither looked happy to see Roland. The privacy screen around Ibarra's cell was still up. The first guard wrapped his nightstick against the bars and the static electricity snapped in the air. He pointed the tip at Roland.
The prisoner will move to the rear of the cell. Face the wall, go to his knees and interlace fingers behind his head.
And if I don't? Roland asked.
Then you don't eat,
the second guard said as he raised the tray slightly. The rumble in Roland's stomach was motivation enough to comply. He got up slowly and shuffled toward the back of the cell. It would take time to learn the guard's routine, to spot errors that he could exploit. Just because he was outside his armor didn't mean he was done fighting. He went to his knees and loosely laced his fingers together. He heard the cell door swing open, then two thumps on his bed. The door slammed shut.
The prisoner will have 30 minutes to eat. Leave the tray to the left of the doorway and be prepared to repeat this process when we return,
the first guard said. Roland got back to his feet.
Prisoners of war have rights, he said. Does Earth know I'm alive? What happened to the rest of my lads on Oricon?
The first guard rattled the cell door, then stepped back.
We don't know any of that, sir,
the second guard said.
We're told to feed you 3 times a day and see to your needs. You step out of line and we're authorized to treat you like any other inmate.
The guard with the nightstick slapped it against his gloved palm, and electricity arced down his fingers. Roland wasn't sure what that would do to the cybernetics in his skull and spine, but the effect wouldn't be pleasant.
Who told you this?
Roland asked. 30 minutes, the first guard said. Fail to comply, and the prisoner will be on paste and water until he complies with instructions. The guards left. The vault door slammed behind them, and the whir of pistons groaned through the metal. On his bunk was a bottle of water, a plate of macaroni and cheese, a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and 2 cut-up hot dogs. The utensils were light, made of pressed pulp and shrink-wrapped, useless as weapons. Roland took a bite of the undercooked pasta and gritty cheese sauce. The quality was a few tiers below what he was used to in the army, and almost as bad as what he had at the orphanage, but it still tasted great. Hunger proved to be the best sauce.
How is it? Ibarra asked.
Where the metal man leaned against his cell bars, frost grew slowly around the metal. The privacy screen had come down as silently as it had gone up.
They don't feed you?
Roland took a sniff of the stale sandwich and dipped a corner into the cheese goo.
I don't eat, Ibarra said. My body runs off ambient heat. Don't drink or sleep either. Who are the guards? Pair of big dummies with no necks?
Roland nodded quickly and kept eating.
Tweedledee and Tweedle asshole, Ibarra said. I had a number of other affectionate terms for them. Then they stopped coming in to check on me.
I can't imagine why,
Roland deadpanned.
Ha ha. Look who has jokes.
Ibarra pointed to the ceiling.
I guess there are a few topics that are off limits. That's why they cut me off. Tell me, did the baseball league ever get up and running?
Baseball?
Roland wiped his sleeve across his mouth.
Sticks! Bats!
Ibarra said, tossing an imaginary ball up and then swinging at it.
America's pastime? Far superior sport than football. American and European. Do you know how much money I spent on stadiums and teams across the solar system?
Oh, that. President Garrett threw out a first pitch a few years back at McDougal Stadium. I never had money to go to a game. Could never find the live games online, never got into it.
Ah! Blackout days still work. Your father never took you to a game?
He died with 8th Fleet deep in the void. Mom was on Luna when the Zorro smashed it. I was just a kid.
Ibarra looked away.
Sorry to hear that. I remember when Luna fell. Those were some dark days. You wouldn't believe how close we came to losing it all. I grew up hearing about you. Even before the war with the Zorros, your name was on everything. Then came the war and you were still all over the place, even though you were just a hologram. A couple kids at school thought you weren't real at all, that you were some sort of fake, the Ka'Resh probe made to control all of us.
Jimmy was talented in many things,
Ibarra said.
Acting like a human being was not one of them. Even after all those years working with him, he could impersonate me about as well as you could infiltrate a flock of geese.
The Ka'Resh probe was named Jimmy?
He had a quantum state designation, well, the Ka'Resh were like that, which was a pain in the ass to say, so I called him Jimmy. Sue me.
You want to meet him?
Ibarra went to his desk and opened the drawer. He removed a needle of glass that caught the light.
It was over 100 years ago that he plopped down in the Arizona desert and gave me a call. His spark went out after the war, but I kept him around. Hard to imagine being without him. That Stacy let me keep him tells me there's hope I might get out of here someday. Otherwise, she'd have me at the engineer center being worked on to find out just how indestructible this body is, or isn't. She let you keep something, too, I see.
Ibarra set the needle in his palm and rolled it from side to side. Roland looked down at his plate and frowned.
Let me keep what?
The armor soldier asked.
What's under your pillow?
Roland lifted up the corner of his threadbare pillow and found a small book. Strips of green tape reinforced the cover and masked the title. He opened it up and found it was a Templar study book. Pages of prayers, instructions for wearing the cross, and handwritten annotations in the margins of the text. He He flipped to the front page, and at the bottom was written Property B.B.
"This isn't mine," Roland said. "I have one just like it, though."
Ibarra peered at the pages.
"You're a Templar?" he asked.
"I've not stood the vigil, but I've pledged myself to the Order."
"Is it true that all the armor that left with you were Templars?" Roland asked.
"It is," Ibarra said, glancing up at the ceiling as if that admission would get the privacy screens turned back on. "Convincing Herson's squadron to come with us wasn't too difficult, as I'm sure you understand."
"No, actually, I don't understand."
Roland took a bite of his sandwich and chewed slowly, forcing Ibarra to wait.
"Templars swear to defend Earth, to sacrifice for the good of all, to live up to St. Colin's legacy and to be the iron that strengthens the hearts of others. We don't take off with a traitor that didn't get his way with a treaty."
"The original oath was to defend humanity, not Earth," Ibarra said.
"Wrong. I have to memorize all this before I can stand the vigil. I'll show you, page 37.
Roland flipped pages and cleared his throat.
"For I swear on my honor and my life that to serve humanity..."
"Wait." He frowned and went back to the beginning of the book.
"This was published 10 years ago. We didn't leave Earth because we were throwing a tantrum over the Hale Treaty," Ibarra said. "We left to save Earth, to keep our deadliest weapon from being tossed aside to please an enemy that never truly wanted peace. There were some in the Armor Corps that understood this, and some that didn't." "What about the civilian transport ship High Command said you destroyed, the Hiawatha? You were about to be indicted for murder."
"That seems like a better reason to run off than what you're going on about," Roland said.
"The Hiawatha?"
Ibarra frowned, then recognition filled his face.
"That? They tried to pin that on me? President Garrett had all the details about that little blip right after it happened. He was all for it after I told him. I do him a favor and give him plausible deniability in case of blowback, and what does he do? Hangs that albatross around my neck after I'm gone, that bastard!"
"So you did blow up that ship and kill all those people?"
"It's not like I had a choice. The Saros were days away, and everyone on board was a..."
The privacy screen shot up and cut Ibarra off. Roland sighed and looked up at the ceiling. He took a bite of his hot dog and shook his head.
"How about you just give us a list of what we can talk about?"
he said through a half-full mouth, before he turned his attention back to the study book and went to the chapter with the poems of remembrance. Chapter 4 Ignar walked through the officer's mess, his nutrient shake in hand. The smell of everyone else's meal used to bother him when he left the hospital. Now the aromas seemed to give his daily goo a bit of flavor. He went past a round table of Dotari officers, all sitting shoulder to shoulder and eating from communal bowls of the Garuda nuts that they never seemed to tire of. Some were armor, the rest pilots from the Ardennes joint squadron. As he sat down at an empty table, he heard a high trill. The grates on the air conditioning vents looked normal and recently cleaned, but the pitch warbled up and down as he dug a knuckle against the back of his jaw and debated scheduling a hearing test with the medics. It was bad enough that he had to speak through cybernetics. Bad hearing would make his non-armored life even more difficult. Shariel practically slapped her tray down across from Ignar as she sat down quickly, her head bowed, her gaze squarely on the small bowl of steaming Garuda. The noise stopped. Ignar's brow furrowed further and he touched the other side of his prosthetic jaw.
"Shariel, when did you come aboard? How are you feeling?"
"Just docked. I'm fine. Totally fine."
She snatched up a Garuda and ate it quickly, still refusing to look at Ignar.
"You look different. Your skin is a few shades darker, and your quills are..."
He sniffed the air, then took a whiff from the end of his straw.
"What is that smell? It's like cut grass and lemons. That some sort of new spice on your lunch?"
By the ships of my ancestors, this is embarrassing.
She pressed her hands against the side of her face, then flapped the back of her fingers against the bottom of her beak.
What is that?
He glanced at the bottom of his boots.
Ah, it lingers.
It's me. The smell is from me, okay? Just drink your goo so we can leave.
She munched on another nut, cracking it loudly.
Were the showers out on your way back from Mars? Now,
he cocked an ear to the ceiling.
There's that sound again. You hear it?
Shareel pushed her bowl to one side and folded her arms on the table.
Eignar, I need you to do something for me. Bang your fist on the table and look agitated,
she said, looking at him with a plea in her eyes.
Now it's weird, Shareel. Very weird.
The keening grew louder, and other human diners began to look around in confusion.
I'll explain in a minute. Just do it, she said.
Eignar shrugged, lifted his cup of nutrient paste off the table, and struck a hammer blow against the corner. The tip broke off, and the entire mess hall went silent. The table full of Dotari males turned their attention back to their food, occasionally glancing back over at Shareel.
What the hell? Eignar asked.
My pheromones are eliciting a response from the men. They're preening for me. That's the sound you heard.
Shareel flushed around her eyes and across her forehead.
Back up, Eignar said. I'm missing something.
This is a very normal Dotari mating behavior. During the season, entire villages will be filled with song.
Shareel tilted her forearm up from the table and blocked her view of the table full of the males as she kept eating.
Mating season?
Eignar set his cup down and pushed it to one side.
Those of us in the Dotari Expeditionary Force had our reproductive cycles put on hold while we served. But the Council of Firsts put an end to that. Ha, ha. Now, our biological impulses are coming to the fore. Don't make it weird.
Wait, what? Why did I have to hit the table?
As my lancemate, you fill the role of Ushulra, an older male relative that keeps suitors away. Well, you shouldn't, as you're not Dotari. In fact, I shouldn't have asked you to get involved. Feces! I'm only making things worse for us both.
She rubbed her temple.
So much for not making it weird, Eignar said. How long does...
He sniffed twice.
Does all this last?
I don't actually know. I've not had to deal with any of this since I entered the academy years ago. There are some environmental factors at work that are making things worse.
Eignar shook his head.
And I thought dealing with Roland's hormones were a problem.
There was a slam of fists against the table and a Dotari male stood up. He was larger than the others and wore a pilot's overalls. He glared at another Dotari across the table and his quills furled out as he hissed. The other Dotari, the plugs at the base of his skull marking him out as armor, rose to his feet slowly, then beat his hands against his chest. The Dotari table suddenly burst into action as one half grabbed the pilot and the other manhandled the armor in opposite directions, the air alive with a cacophony of squawks and chirps. As quickly as the din erupted, it ended, as the two factions left through opposite doors.
What the hell was that?
A ranger lieutenant asked from behind Eignar. Shareel kept her head down and chewed through her bowl as fast as she could manage.
Eignar,
she said as she chewed.
What are your opinions of this, Please be honest.
I'm starting to wish the Ibaras had captured me instead of Roland.
Chapter 5 The hood over Roland's head cut out all light and sound, but he felt his seat shudder as whatever transport he was in came to a stop. The half-mask over his mouth kept his jaw clenched tight and muzzled. Some armor soldiers used the seclusion hoods to fall asleep when out of armor, their bodies so used to the sensory deprivation that resting was almost impossible outside the wombs. Roland noted the count of this newest transition, 9,482,